music each week, then you're in the right place. You can catch that all Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on CFRC.
Revelation Radio. Explore the sound shaping subculture. Tune in to 101.9 CFRC Wednesdays from 11 to noon to uncover revelations mixed into music from across the alternative scene, underground, and across the globe.
No rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Revelation Radio, Wednesdays at 11.
Have you ever been to extended family Kingston?
Stop by and visit our programs and talk to our staff to find out how our staff will support you.
So many things we like best are golf,
doing crafts,
hair and friends,
and gardening.
I like doing everything at EAF. We just love extended family.
Visit us at www.efkingston.com.
Come on down to EFK, located at 660 Baggett Street, for a great time. Be a part of our extended family.
Come to extended family.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Israelis and Palestinians are marking 2 years since the October 7th, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. Almost 1,200 people were killed. About 250 were taken hostage. 48 hostages remain in Gaza, with 20 believed to be alive. In Israel, a moment of silence was held today to remember the victims of October 7th. For Palestinians, today marks the start of a third year of a genocide that's left much of Gaza uninhabitable. The official death toll in Gaza surpassed 67,000, but that number is believed to be a vast underestimate. More than 460 Palestinians have starved to death as famine spreads across Gaza. About a quarter of them are believed to be children. An estimated 2,700 Palestinian families have been completely erased from the civil registry over the past 2 years. On Monday, ceasefire talks began in Egypt over President Trump's 20-point plan that includes a call for the swap of all remaining hostages in Gaza for Palestinian prisoners held in Israel, as well as an eventual Israeli military withdrawal from Gaza. But major questions remain over what both Israel and Hamas will agree to. We begin today's show, this segment in Gaza. We're joined by Ad Amawi, representative of the Gaza Relief Committee, coordinator for local NGOs based in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. We tried to reach you yesterday, but had technical problems. Ad, describe what's happening on the ground.
Thank you, Amy. I hope the ceasefire will be implemented soon. But the real situation here over the ground, nothing tangible change. But they halt some huge bombardment, attacks, and explosive robotics. But yesterday night, they return attack a shelter camp in the western part of the Gaza City with a huge bombardment, and caused more than, within the last 48 hours, more than 50 martyrs and more than 50 injuries. So the situation is something like stabilizing the current situation without a huge bombardment for all hours, but still attacking between time to time. And also they sieged Gaza town and they prevent the coastal road and they prevent the return of the civilians again to the Gaza City. And they announce officially they prevent Al-Rashid Street used by our displacement people to return to the Gaza City. So the situation is just constant and stabilized with the current situation, with no tangible changes over the ground here. And also there is no withdrawals from the encouraged area around the Gaza City especially, and the east part of Rafah and Khan Yunis. So the situation is just stabilized like that.
thank you so much for joining us. We have a very, very, very important conversation today. Firstly, I would love to introduce our guest, Diana Bhutu, who is a lawyer, political analyst, has worked for years in Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, and to our great fortune is also a Zateo contributor. Diana, thank you first so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Prem. It's really nice to see you and to be able to chat with you.
Absolutely. Thank you. So today, of course, we are chatting about Trump's, as they call it, peace plan, the presentation of this plan at the White House, how it came together, what exactly is in this supposed peace plan, and whether or not we think there's any meat to it. Before we dive into assessing the terms of this deal, Diana, what did you make of the logistics? For example, that the plan was being rolled out as Netanyahu was forced to apologize to Qatar on camera for conducting a strike there last month, or that the plan was presented essentially as Hamas, you have to accept this deal made without Palestinian input, or the genocide will continue. What did you make of all of these elements of the plan?
Oh, gosh, where do I begin? So first, I want to roll back a little bit. The first thing that really struck me is that in devising this plan, not only were there no Palestinians there, but Palestinians were deliberately excluded. Mahmoud Abbas was not allowed to go to the United Nations to address the United Nations. And I'm pretty certain that Trump didn't meet with the UN representative to Palestine, Riyad Mansour. So this was a plan that was devised entirely without Palestinian input, very colonial, right? So we're going to impose on you. We're going to tell you what needs to be done. The second thing that really struck me as it was being unveiled was just how Israeli it sounded and how so many of the terms were very Israeli. And we'll get into this, I'm sure, Prem. But that really struck me in the language that was used, in the way that it was unveiled. But even one thing, as I was watching the images that came out of the White House, immediately after the press conference, there was a photo that emerged of the apology. And the photo that emerged that was presented in the Israeli media was a picture of Trump on the phone with Netanyahu seated, as though it was President Trump who was apologizing to the Qataris, not Netanyahu doing any such thing. And it was only the following day that we saw the White House ended up releasing the photos of Netanyahu. And I say this because there's long been this tension, or let's say, and put it in another way, Netanyahu's long bragged that he's the person who's calling the shots, that it's not the United States is calling the shots, that he's the person in control. And I think that there is more to it than that. But when you have somebody like Netanyahu who's trying to show that he's the person in control and then is the one who's showing these images, this is the image that he's trying to project to the Israelis.
I think that opens this discussion up quite well. And before I move on forward, just a reminder to everyone who's listening right now, please submit your questions in the Q&A below. We're very lucky to have Dion here with us, and we're going to try to answer as many questions as we can. So please, you know, if you have any thoughts, questions, we would love to hear them. On to the terms itself. You talk about how Israeli the deal felt in a way. Something that struck me was kind of familiar to how much of the Western media covers Gaza, which was right away point number one, making Gaza a de-radicalized, terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbors. It is not lost on you, and not lost on many of our listeners, but this is a plan welcomed by Israel, which, as a reminder, has attacked Palestine, Iran, Lebanon, Qatar, Syria, Yemen, Tunisia, and international waters. As a reminder, whose soldiers have taken selfies with the underwear of women whose houses they destroyed. As a reminder, whose army generals and most supportive media figures express rhetoric often indistinguishable to that of the Nazis or the genocidal Rwandan radio. What do you make of this refrain officially now in the terms of this supposed deal on de-radicalizing Gaza?
Well, there's two things. The first is how quickly the script was flipped. So suddenly it's that Palestinians have to negotiate an end to their genocide. And that part is so repugnant, Prem. This idea that Palestinians are to blame for the genocide, and we're going to keep hearing this on and on and on and on. But then also the idea that Israel and the United States, the country that is committing genocide and the country that's funding the genocide, should have any say in what happens to Palestinians is also horrifying. I mean, they just, when you look at, why is it that when you look at what they have done, how they have decimated Gaza, and all of my friends who are there and people who've been there and who come out say there's nothing to describe it. It's apocalyptic scenes. Why is it that Israel should have any say in the way that Gaza is run? But more than that, I think that this de-radicalization should be on Israeli society. You know, I live in a place where 82% of Israelis, this is a poll that came out in March, and I actually wrote about it for Zateo, 82% of Israelis believe and support the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. 56% of Israelis support the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians like me, who hold Israeli citizenship. And the younger you go, the higher the percentage is. So talk about de-radicalization. It's the other way around. It's the Israeli society needs to be de-radicalized because they've never been forced they've never been forced to account for anything that they've done for all of these years, for 77 years. They've never been forced to account for anything that they've done.
It's interesting. You talk about how the onus of this plan is so clearly on the idea of sort of, if not ethnically cleansing, at least sort of spiritually cleansing the people of Gaza and the people of Palestine, as if their spirits have been destroyed by Israel enough over the past 2 years. There's also numerous terms in this deal. For example, it says if both sides agree, the war will end, but Israel doesn't have to withdraw fully until the hostage release. It says no one will be forced to leave Gaza. People can stay if they so choose. Gaza will be redeveloped for the benefit of the people of Gaza, who, as the deal says, have suffered more than enough. What do you make of terms like these that kind of frame this all as somehow a favor, actually, to the Palestinians? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you exactly hit it on the head, is the favor part. But let's go into the issue of the withdrawal. So right now in Gaza, there's a couple of things happening. Just yesterday, I believe it was, the Israeli army and the Israeli so-called defense minister issued orders to, there's roughly about 250,000 people who are still in Gaza City and in the north. They issued orders saying that anybody who remains in Gaza City will be considered a terrorist or a terrorist supporter. And what they're doing is they're setting this up for massacres, like mass massacres. And you can see the writing on the wall, right? This is the path that they're going down. My friends who were in Gaza City left, and leaving is not easy. It costs thousands of dollars. The way down is not easy. The reason that they're leaving is both out of fear, but also because there are no services there. So electricity, internet, and so on. Everything has been cut. So what this means is that the vast majority of the population of Gaza is now in 18% of the Gaza Strip. So following this plan, what the plan says is that upon the release of the Israeli captives, that the army will then pull back, right? But, you know, Prem, I've been around the block a few times, and I know this coalition. And this coalition is made up of some people, I don't know what the word is, like these lunatics, including Ben-Gvir, including Smotrich, and they throw the occasional fit. It's not the occasional fit. They throw a fit every day. And I can just see them say, okay, yes, we got the Israelis back, but no, we're not going to pull out. Who is going to, and if you do try to pull out, we're going to leave the coalition. Who's going to force Israel to pull out? Who's going to do that? Nobody. And so rightfully, Palestinians are looking at this and saying, you're really just talking about 72 hours. That's it. There's going to be like 72 hours where there's nothing or no bombs, but the rest of the time we're just going to remain shoved into 18% of the Gaza Strip, with no possibility of ever getting out of it. So there's a lot of skepticism. At the same time, people in Gaza are saying, we're done. We've had it. We want this over. And so again, I go back to this idea of like, why is it that Palestinians have to negotiate an end to their genocide? And they've set it up that either you accept this, or if you don't accept this, then you're to blame for the genocide.
Mm. And you talk about some of the people involved in this. Of course, there's the far right ministers who surely we can't trust by any means of the word trust. There's also people who are being brought in, I guess, framed in such a way that almost to be seen as credible voices, but some might see as the Avengers of war crimes. And of course, one mm-hmm. such name we think of is Tony Blair. Mm-hmm. Part of this vision is a so-called Board of Peace chaired by Trump with the involvement of the likes of Blair. Atalia Omer, she asks us, or they ask us, I should say, if you could speak about the role of Blair, this retrieval of a war criminal, and how we can understand this supposed peace plan in terms of that broader recent history. Of course, Blair, the former Prime Minister of UK, who was just as overzealous of invading Iraq. So firstly, let's start there. How we can understand this peace plan in terms of people like him being so potentially eminently involved in overseeing it?
The real question. Okay, so first I'll go into the why, and then I'm going to go into another issue. So the first is like, who invited you? Like, who asked you, Blair, to come in and do anything? I certainly didn't ask you. I'm pretty sure nobody in Gaza asked you to come in. And once again, there was no consultation with any Palestinians, so I'm pretty sure nobody asked you to come in. That's one. But then, of course, we have his record. And he's done enough to destroy one country in the Middle East. He doesn't need to destroy a second. So, the idea that he's going to come in and that he's going to do anything, this reeks of colonialism. And again, this is the problem with it. You know, going back to your earlier question, Prem, I think that so much of this plan and the reason that it is so vague is not only because it suits Israel's interests, but because it's Trump. He's not a person who really looks at details. It's just like, just get something, just get it off my, you know, I don't want to think about it anymore, and let's just get it going. And even the way that he talked about it at the press conference, he talked about it as being a thousands of years conflict. He's older than the state of Israel. He himself is older than the state of Israel. And so it goes to show you that he just doesn't want to get mired in any of these details. Once again, Palestine is for Palestinians to be determining. It's not for the likes of Tony Blair. It's not for a Trump peace coalition. It's for us to determine. And it's for Israel to get out. It's for us to hold Israel to account, and it's for us to be able to do what we want with it and to rebuild it, with Israel paying, by the way.
Hmm. On the note of the basic truth that Palestinians, as anyone else, deserves their own self-determination, statehood was not made concrete in this plan. The plan instead describes the idea as an aspiration for which conditions may finally be in place for a credible pathway after Gaza is rebuilt and the supposed new authority structure is in place. And of course, again, part of this vision of rebuilding and this new authority structure involves this Board of Peace, involves rebuilding done at the hands of people for whom neocolonialism's Wikipedia entry has their names listed on them. Atalia, again, and I asked this as well, how do you, like, is this materially different from the absurd Gaza Riviera vision that was proffered just months ago, or is that just the Riviera with a few slapdash bows tied on top of it?
It's exactly, it's the same plan as the Riviera plan. Actually, when the Trump plan came out, I started to look at it and started to look at the Riviera plan, and they're not identical, but there's a lot of the, you know, the same sorts of thinking. But I want to step back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Back in 2005, when the Israelis disengaged, or using their term, from Gaza, and what that meant is, at the time there had been 21 settlements that were in the Gaza Strip that had taken up about 20% of the land of the Gaza Strip, and there were about 7,000 settlers. So in 2005, the Israelis pulled out the settlers and the settlements. And at the time, they had this obsession with Singapore. And they used to say to us, oh, now you could turn into Singapore. Now the new obsession is Dubai, right? Like, that's the new, like, the new shiny toy is Dubai. And so, you know, they used to say to us, like, yeah, you know, you could turn it into Singapore, or now Dubai. But for all of their obsessions, what they've never understood is that, one, who says we want to turn it into Singapore or Dubai? But then two is the level of control that Israel has over the Gaza Strip is so tight that even if we wanted to turn it into Dubai or Singapore, we wouldn't be able to. Like, when I lived there, Prem, and it's only gotten worse, when I lived in Gaza in 2005, do you know that I never saw a commercial airplane in the sky? Not once. You don't see them. You see army planes, but never once a commercial flight. Do you know that of all of the people I met in Gaza, like 9 out of 10 of them had never left the Gaza Strip? Mm-hmm. They had never met anybody from the West Bank. They'd mm-hmm. never met anybody from 48 Palestine. And this was not unusual because they were living under a system of isolation, of control, of suffocation. So even in their dreams of having this Riviera or the Dubai or whatever it is, it's just a talking point. But ultimately what Israel wants is to maintain the control and then blame us for not building what their fantasy is. It's this a friend of mine called it like the terra forma, right? Where they want to create a new land. But they ignore that actually Gaza has so much history. One of the oldest churches is in Gaza. Some of the oldest mosques are in Gaza. Yeah. These are places that have had long civilization. And yet they want to erase that to create this like Dubai or Singapore, whatever it is, because they don't have that same connection that we do.
Yeah, yeah. And you talk about this economic development plan, this effort to turn Gaza into something that it isn't. The plan refers to a panel of experts who have helped birth some of the thriving modern miracle cities in the Middle East. And it describes Gaza in the interim being temporarily governed by this transitional technocratic committee made up of what they call qualified Palestinians, international experts, of course, all overseen by the Board of Peace. With this plan referring to
this name.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's absurd. It's absurd. It's like everything else. It's beyond Orwellian. War is peace, et cetera, et cetera. When this plan refers to these, you know, supposedly friendly faces and experts that will help oversee this all, do you have any sense of who this is even referring to?
No clue. I have no clue. And I don't think anybody has any clue, because what they've done is they've excluded the Palestinian Authority. And I'm going to talk about the conditions that they put on the Palestinian Authority. So they've mm-hmm. excluded the Palestinian Authority. And so clearly they have somebody in their mind of fantasy, but we have no clue who they are. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the Palestinian Authority, you know, what they've done is they've said to the PA that, you know, we as you put it, like, if you behave, then, you know, we'll think about your aspirations, we're going to have a right to self-determination. But if you behave, and the behaving part which it wasn't clear in the text, but it is clear to people who know, is that they want the Palestinian Authority to drop all of the cases before the International Criminal Court. They want all of the cases dropped before the International Court of Justice, and they want a complete revamp when it comes to anything in relation to textbooks, you know, all this sort of stuff. So, but the main thing that they want is, again, to drop any of the lawsuits that are going after Israel. So what they're looking for is if you behave and you don't hold us to account, then maybe we'll think of saying that, yes, you perhaps have a right. And that's it. Again, very colonial.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to bring in a few other questions here from some of our viewers. There's two attendees that actually wrap quite well. One anonymous attendee asks if there are any other countries or the UN, any other bodies proposing their own plan to end the war. They say, how are we left with just the US and Bibi Netanyahu dictating this? And then, we have as well, Sean Elliott, who asks whether Egypt, Jordan, or the Gulf countries, whether they have any real influence or if there's just only statements of concern as being the most that they can offer.
So these two are really quite combined, and and thanks exactly. for both of them. So, this plan came out at the same time as a number of states were recognizing the state of Palestine. And one of my concerns with this whole wave of recognition was that it was just very performative. And instead of these countries recognizing that Israel is committing genocide and then stopping genocide, that instead they're just going to recognize the state of Palestine. And so what is it that they can do? There's lots of things. They can stop the flow of weapons. There's a lot of countries that ship parts for, particularly for the F-35s. They can stop the flow of weapons. They can put trade sanctions. They can halt their trade agreements. They can kick Israel out of the United Nations. It's been done in the past with South Africa. They can kick Israel out of all of these bodies. Like, they can stop treating Israel as a normal country. So this can all be done, and it must be done. But instead, what they did is they recognized the state of Palestine, and then that was it. When this plan was then came out, all of these countries then immediately welcomed it. So France came out and welcomed it. Holland came out and welcomed it. All of the Arab states came out and welcomed it. And it's for two reasons. One is that some of the states welcomed it because they want to see an end to the genocide. But then some of them welcomed it because it gave them a pass. It means that they don't have to do anything now. And that's, again, this is the problem, is that we all want to see an end to the genocide. We all want to see this over. And at the same time, I don't want to see that Israel gets to do this again. Because what this plan is going to do is it's going to give Israel a pass to be able to commit genocide again and again and again and again. All of the guarantees that are built into this agreement, or this plan, excuse me, are for the Israeli side. There's not a single guarantee that's given to Palestinians, not one. So that any time that Israel, and Israel has always has the veto, anytime it doesn't meet Israel's standards, they can do whatever they want again. And again, who's going to stop them? Who is going to stop them?
We talk about how familiar so much of this feels, both in terms of the horrors and damage, but also the people making all that happen. One anonymous attendee asks us, how can the world hold Israel to account without holding the US and Britain to account for what they have done? They say that they are co-conspirators. Is the inability to hold all accountable part of this entire conundrum?
Yes and no. There are ways to hold Israel to account through all the mechanisms that I just mentioned. And yes, I do think that there's going to be a time where these other two countries are also, as well as Germany, by the way, and maybe Italy as well. And the reason I'm saying Germany is because Germany gives a lot of weapons. Italy is the third largest supplier of weapons to Israel. And so, yes, I think that there's going to be a reckoning at one point in time. It's all sadly too late, Prem. It's all sadly too late.
Yeah. You mentioned this a little bit ago, but I figure we should bring it up just to put a fine point on this. In the plan, it says that the Israeli military will withdraw based on different metrics of demilitarization, standards agreed upon by the Israelis, the U.S., and these other overseers involved. Is this plan not just a blueprint for the U.S. and the West to really functionally just be a nanny interstate overseer and to hamstring rather than even remotely increase the possibility of actual Palestinian self-determination?
Absolutely. The agreement, I keep calling it agreement, it's not. Yeah. The plan calls for the establishment of this international security force made up of forces from different countries, including Arab and Muslim countries and all this stuff. And believe me, Israel's going to veto anybody who's going to come. And so the Israeli army is going to remain there. But let's assume that there's goodwill and they allow them to come in. What are the metrics? Who's going to be the one who decides? At what point do they decide? And what guarantees are there? So again, all of this is to say that we as Palestinians have been down this path. And the reason I'm saying this is the Oslo Accords were signed back in 1993. The first major agreement came out in May of 1994. It was supposed to conclude in May of 1999, 5 years. We're now in the year 2025, September of 2025. That same agreement from May of 1994 is still in place. What's temporary became permanent, except for the settlements. The settlements, which were supposed to be temporary, have become permanent. And so we've seen this, we've seen this horror show. We know the ending. And all of the vagueness that is written into this plan is all just serving Israel's interests. It's not serving Palestinian interests. And that's why that's why you're seeing so many people who are saying that they're very concerned. And that even if you use it just as a basis for a future, that it's going to require such a long time just to be able to negotiate, to iron out. And what's going to happen to the people of Gaza during that period? They're still going to be caged into a very, very, very tiny parcel of Gaza, because Israel, even if they pull out to that secondary line, it's still not even 30% of Gaza. So you can just see what the long-term impact is that people are going to continue to be caged in. Now, the other part of this, Prem, is that you and I haven't been to Gaza. We don't know what it's like. But my friends who are there are telling me just how toxic it is, with all of the bombs that have been dropped, with all the unexploded ordnance, all that stuff there. We don't even know where to begin or where to end. And again, it's going to be like, who gets to decide? Who's deciding what gets built and what doesn't get built? What gets cleared, what doesn't get cleared? And it's a recipe for, it's the vagueness is a recipe for Israel to do what it wants.
On that note, we have two questions from two different attendees that I think are also similarly kind of tied to each other. One asks, if a ceasefire is to happen, if a deal is to be made, what would it mean for Netanyahu's corruption charges that he's facing? And another attendee asks, on the same vein, does tying the deal to a hard deadline backed by threats that, quote, all hell will break loose, make it more likely that Hamas will negotiate in? Or does it risk hardening positions and undermining dialogue? So we kind of have these questions regarding the negotiation state, whether, and sort of the incentive structures beneath them on both sides.
I don't know what Hamas is going to do. and I have no idea what they're going to do. And I'm not sure what all hell will break loose actually means.
Yeah.
All hell already has broken loose in,
right.
in Gaza. I don't know how much worse it's going to be.
Yeah.
It's not as though, you know, Trump hasn't held, he hasn't reined in Israel at all during the during this period of time. So I don't know what all hell will break loose actually looks like. Yeah, I really don't know.
Yeah, yeah. And then on the question regarding, you know, Netanyahu's incentives, for instance,
oh,
if
yes.
the war is to come to an end, what does that mean yeah. for his own political standing and political security in Israel?
His trial's been going on now for, I think it's about 5 years now. And yes, he has these corruption charges. And yes, he's doing anything possible to remain in and remain in office. And surprise, surprise, the latest polls are showing that that if there is an election tomorrow, he'll win. He will win. And which just blows the mind. So I think he'll continue to remain in office. He's going to continue to remain in office. So, you know, I said at the beginning, like 2 years ago, that the only way that Netanyahu will be able to survive is if he decimates Gaza. Or if he manages to secure some sort of regional, like get peace with Saudi, for example. Mm. Over time, I grew to realize that Israelis don't care for peace with Saudi Arabia. They're not even looking at the Arab states any longer. And the only way that he's going to politically survive is if he decimates Gaza. And so he has. So he has. Hmm. And so he has.
Yeah. We have a few quick final questions here. I know we're pushing on time here. One, we spoke a little bit about this, but I'm curious, do you see any guardrails for accountability in this plan, any sort of guarantee for a deliverance of goals, accomplish things on any timeline, preventing Israel from doing what it has done, as we've seen over and over again, which is tanking ceasefire deals? Is there any mechanism to even accomplish the insufficient goals that we deem as, you know, maybe insufficient or unjust or what have you, any measure to accomplish any of these?
Nothing. Prem, it's even worse than that. When looking at the numbers as they've been laid out, they're talking about the Israelis and releasing Israelis. But then if you look at the numbers of what they're talking about in terms of Palestinians, it's 250 Palestinians. And then only 1,700 Palestinians who've been picked up post October 7th. These are people who are from Gaza. These are people who shouldn't have been picked up to begin with. So what this means is that there's an additional 10,000 plus who are languishing in Israeli prisons, some of them in dungeons, who are being tortured, who are being starved, who are being raped. This is all stuff that we know. And there's no mechanism for any of these people to be released. 450 of them, by the way, are children. The vast majority of them are hostages because they were picked up without any charge, without any trial, without anything. And so there's no mechanism for any of these people to be released as well. Plus there's, I can't even remember the number now. There's hundreds. I won't say the exact number because I lost count. Hundreds of bodies that Israel continues to hold of Palestinians from years and years and years of dead Palestinians from years and years and years ago. And even that is not being released. So there's no mechanism for accountability within the plan itself. But even beyond that, there's just such a focus on just one side and not even looking at what caused this to begin with. It's just these levels of dehumanization and the idea that Palestinians have never been treated as human. And here we come out with another plan that once again doesn't treat Palestinians as humans. It lords over them.
Hmm. One final thought here that I would love to get your reflection on. One thing that's always struck me is how at these supposed threshold points, the brinks of at least some kind of resolution, one could imagine that those committing violence would maybe tap the brakes as some sort of at least sign of good faith. But in every instance before this, in the lead up to, for example, the so-called humanitarian pauses, Israel has often escalated its violence as if trying to sneak in as much as possible before having to pause for as long as they feel they need to. As we speak right now, there are still daily massacres being conducted by Israel. Just yesterday, Israel killed Omar Hayek, a 42-year-old healthcare worker with Doctors Without Borders. He was with his colleagues. They were all wearing their vests. They were waiting to go to the field hospital. This was an attack after the peace plan was announced. From your perspective, as someone who's been involved in negotiation and diplomacy, who has been so intimately familiar with this specific story, what are your reflections on how Israel and the U.S. have conducted themselves diplomatically over the past 2 years? How should we, as everyday people, perceive them in their sort of fundamental essence and whether they should be taken honestly?
Trump is a bully. We know that. And so his mode of operating is by bullying people and by showing the world that he is kind of erratic enough that you don't want to be on his bad side. And that's why he's been giving these ultimatums, these deadlines, these, you know, just the ways in which that he's been behaving. But so too is Netanyahu. It's the same mentality of bullying of they're war criminals. I mean, these are criminals. But these are not negotiators. These are not people who are thinking long term. If Trump were thinking long term, this would not be a plan that I would put forward. If Netanyahu were thinking long term, this would not be a plan that I'd put forward. His thinking is very short term, because it's all about A, his political survival, and B, keeping Israel in a place where it's constantly in a state of emergency, and in a place where Israelis are always looking around, and keeping the police state going. That's the whole point of it. That's the whole point of it.
Finally, Joanne Robinson, she says, not a question. My heart just breaks. Thank you, Diana, for your steadfastness, honest, and powerful voice. And I have to say, I completely agree. Diana, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, your expertise, your knowledge. It really means a lot to me personally. It means a lot, I know, to all of our listeners. Evelyn Katz as well says thank you for this discussion as well. And seriously, Diana, we really appreciate it. And everyone who has tuned in, thank you so much for your questions, your thoughts, your support of our work. It is a very, very, very difficult time. It's almost 2 years into this genocide that we've witnessed, one that voices like Diana have been warning for months and months and months of what would come and what has indeed come to pass. And it is very dark, but there's also a lot of humanity seen in places like this and in spaces like this from voices like Diana. And as we've seen over the past few weeks, in terms of all the people speaking out, that humanity is in abundance, not in shortage. And so with all the darkness, remember all of that light. And once again, thank you all for joining us. Thank you for your support.
We end today's show with Plestia Alakat, award-winning Palestinian journalist. She was just 21 years old when Israel's bombardment of Gaza began 2 years ago. Her online videos went viral, were seen around the world. This is a video from October 9th, 2023.
For my neighbors, they didn't evacuate as well. They have their windows down. Here are their windows. And here is the family. They're gathering all together, also in a place far away from the wind. I was trying to explain things, but I think you can hear them now. I got to check on my parents.
Plestia Alakat now has 4 million followers on Instagram. She's just published her first book. It's called The Eyes of Gaza, A Diary of Resilience, based on excerpts of the diary she kept in the weeks after October 7th. On October 19th, she wrote, quote, "This isn't an aggression anymore. It's a genocide. There isn't another word that can describe the scale of violence I see in front of me." 2 weeks later, she wrote, quote, "Every night, I wonder if it will be the last of my life. Will there be a tomorrow? I try to look at my family, to gaze at and memorialize their faces just in case." Plastia Lakha joins us now from a studio in Beirut, Lebanon, where she's studying media. Plastia, thanks so much for being with us. You know, you left us in that video talking about checking on your parents. It was a devastating video because as you were speaking, there were bombs going off outside. You opened the window and you showed it was just a cloud. You couldn't see beyond. Talk about your experience of the last 2 years.
Unfortunately, Israel succeeded in isolating and dividing Gaza from the rest of the world. Meaning your experience as a Gazan Palestinian person living in Gaza is different than your experience if you're living elsewhere. For example, kids in Gaza grow up afraid of the sky. When you look at the sky in Gaza, you can't differentiate, is this a cloud or is this a smoke? The whole time you're listening to the sounds of drones, quadcopters, airstrikes and bombs. You can't even listen to the sounds of birds like any other normal person. And even the air that is in Gaza, it's polluted because of the bombs and airstrikes and everything. And in Gaza, when you see tent is like displacement, a cold place, it has a negative meaning. But outside of Gaza, tents are usually something nice. Oh, let's go camping. Let's use them for the weekend. And that's Gaza's experience for 2 years. They've been displaced, bombed, trapped, and starved deliberately by Israel in Gaza.
By your metric, as you write in your diary, quote, "I am four Israeli aggressions old." Can you take us back to that day, to the 2 years ago, to the beginning of the Israeli attack and the toll it had taken on you and your loved ones?
History didn't start on October 7, 2023. It's been 2 years of the genocide, but it's been 77 years, if not more, of the ongoing Nakba that started in 1948. I remember on October 7, when I woke up, I listened, like, I heard sounds of bombs, and I slept again, then I woke up again. I immediately, like, jumped out of bed. I went, I saw my mom. She was already on the phone calling the delivery guy. "We want bread, we want flour, we want this and that." And this is a tradition that I know. Whenever I see like a family member doing that and ordering these stuff, I know that something bad about to happen. I then looked out of the window. I saw how full and crowded the streets were and the supermarkets were. Like everyone is just out buying stuff and so on. And I knew that something bad is happening, but I never expected that it will be a genocide that lasts for 2 years.
And you also write at one point in your diaries, quote, "Priority number one, aside from not getting killed, is connecting to the internet so I can update my Instagram." Could you talk about the difficulty of being able to get out the word to the rest of the world of what was happening?
As a journalist, you're supposed to be protected because you're a journalist. It's a profession. You're doing your job. But unfortunately, in Gaza, journalism is apparently a crime, and Israel is targeting and killing journalists. Around 270, if not more, journalists have been killed. And the reason I'm saying if not more, because how are we supposed to know the up-to-date numbers if the people who are also counting the number of dead in Gaza are also getting killed and targeted? I wrote that on Instagram because as a journalist, my job was super difficult. Like even connecting to the internet was a challenge. And even like charging your phone, charging your cameras, finding a power bank, all of that was challenging. You were experiencing the genocide, living it, knowing any minute you'll be killed and targeted, yet you were trying to tell and show the world what's happening, even though you knew that that puts your life at risk.
Plastia, last year, Amnesty International Australia gave you its inaugural Human Rights Defender Award. I wanted to play a compilation of your reporting from Gaza that they highlighted.
It's around 4 p.m., no electricity, no water, no internet, literally just the sounds of bombs.
I'm standing right now inside the first refugee camp in Gaza Strip. I'm at Al-Nasser Hospital right now. There are 80 premature babies in the ICU room. And yesterday, the Israeli warplanes targeted a church where around 200 civilians were inside.
These are the equipments for a journalist that got murdered by the Israeli forces.
As you can see, we can hear the sounds of bombs right now.
But day by day, I'm surprised by things I see. Even during a genocide, a war, ethnic cleansing and displacement and everything, I tried to show the Palestinians living in Gaza who they are, how they are kind to one another, how they are nice, even during these difficult times.
That's Plastia Lakhad reporting from the ground in Gaza. The BBC named her in its 100 Women of the Year list. And now, few years later, I mean, Plastia was 21 at the time. She has a new book. She has a first book, The Eyes of Gaza, A Diary of Resilience. If you can talk about what those 45 days were like that you're covering in this book of your reporting then. You're studying now media in Beirut, but can you talk about your decision to leave and what has happened to the rest of your family?
It wasn't really a decision to leave Gaza. What options do you have? It's either you stay in Gaza and wait to be one of the thousands that are killed, or if you're lucky enough, you get the chance to leave, because not even everyone has the chance to leave if they want. The borders are closed and you need to have another passport. You need to have like a cousin, family member who has another passport to be able to help you out. So even leaving Gaza is a privilege that not everyone can afford or can have. When I was in Gaza for 45 days, I thought it was the worst days of my life, and I thought, oh my God, like, I can't believe this is actually happening. But what I didn't know that the genocide will still be going on for 2 years. My colleagues, my cousins, my friends, most of them are still in Gaza. They're still on the ground. The journalists are still reporting. My friends are still trying to survive. So my experience of 45 days is nothing compared to the experience of the people who are still there and trapped in Gaza. But the reason I chose to write this book, The Eyes of Gaza, is because I've always had a diary. Writing is what I usually do. And for the first time, I wanted it to be us writing about us, not just some people speaking over us and writing about our experience. I wanted us to have our own voice. We already have voices. We just need help in amplifying our voices, not in replacing our voices. So I made sure to write a book written by a person from Gaza to the world.
And Plastia, in that diary, you also talk about hearing of the solidarity movements of young people and students around the world. And you write, quote, "It's beyond what I ever imagined. Here's the thing. The students aren't just calling for a ceasefire. They're also calling for the establishment of the right of return and insisting on a Palestine that is free from the River Jordan all the way to the Mediterranean Sea." Talk about this, the impact of these protest movements on the people of Gaza.
Honestly, as a Palestinian person, the bar has always been low. The expectations has always been almost non-existent. But right now, the world proved us strong. Millions of people worldwide are protesting. They now know our names, they know our stories, and they are amplifying our voices. I'm honestly beyond proud and impressed, especially with the younger generations who are making sure that the genocide doesn't go unnoticed, and they're super vocal and outspoken about it. And right now, the global Sumud Flotilla and what they're doing, what Greta is doing, what all the other activists are doing, how they're literally risking their lives just to deliver aid in Gaza. And even though aid wasn't delivered, their message was delivered, and it gave Palestinians hope. Because Palestinian people were not expecting from the rest of the world, oh, pause your life because we're getting killed. But what we're expecting is solidarity and to be seen. And the world has proved to us that we are seen and that they're standing on the right side of history. And for that, me and all the other Palestinians, I'm sure we're all very grateful.
Plastia, could you read your poem Only in Gaza that you include in your book? If you don't have it with you, if you could... If you could talk about it.
I have it with me. Okay.
So for me, this poem is still a poem in progress, like it's not finished yet. And I hope one day I'll continue this poem and it will be on a positive note, a hopeful note, where the situation in Gaza would be so much better. Only in Gaza, you sleep counting rockets rather than stars. You wake up, if you wake up, to the sounds of bombs rather than birds. Only in Gaza, you sleep not knowing if or how you'll wake up. In Gaza, you sleep in your house and you wake up under the rubble. In Gaza, you sleep with your body parts whole and you wake up missing a hand or a leg. In Gaza, you sleep beside family and friends, and the next day, you are on your own. Only in Gaza, people celebrate birthdays while war echoes in the background, then welcome you into a tent with warm hands and a cup of tea. Only in Gaza, despite the pain, people remain, not just survivors, but warriors.
Plestia reading Only in Gaza, which is included in The Eyes of Gaza, a diary of resilience. Plestia, you say that you prefer to write and to speak when talking about Gaza in English because you find it less painful. Can you talk about that?
English is my second language, not my first language, so I obviously understand Arabic more, and the weight of Arabic words always hits differently because it's my mother tongue. So I feel like whenever I speak in English, I can hide behind the language. That's number one. And number two, I want the whole world to know about what's happening, especially that international journalists are not allowed in. And that's why I made sure since day one to speak in English to make sure everyone knows and sees what's happening in Gaza and to not limit the audience to Arabic-speaking audience only.
And could you talk as well about the community of journalists that are still there covering the war, the comradeship and the bonds that you build together?
One thing I always wonder is who reports on the reporters? Journalists and reporters in Gaza are living the genocide while also reporting it, are facing starvation while also reporting on it. They're reporting on stories of families who lost loved ones while they're also grieving as well. I feel like the most difficult job in the world right now is to be a journalist in Gaza because they're trying to be a journalist while they know they'll be targeted, they know they're not safe, they know they're putting their family's life at risk just because of a profession they chose, and all of that just to show the world what's happening in Gaza.
And can you comment on the number of Palestinian journalists, among them most recently Anas al-Sharif, but more journalists have been killed since Anas was killed, but what this has meant to you and the people you've lost in your life?
I'm honestly in disbelief of when journalism has become a crime instead of being a profession. So I don't understand how is it possible for the world to watch journalists getting killed, and where's the International Committee of protecting journalists? Like, is there anyone who's going to do anything about it?
And what would you hope for the rest of the world to take from your book and your experiences?
So my book is my story and the stories of other people that I meet along the way, and I make sure to mention their story and their name. At some point, the book will make you cry, will make you laugh, will make you joyful, will make you tearful. So I just hope people will do something with all of these emotions, because emotions alone are not enough. Emotions are only powerful when you convert them into actions.
Your book includes the dedication to Gaza, the soul of our souls, all I am and all I will ever become is for you and because of you. Do you hope to return, Plestia, to Gaza?
Of course, I always hope. Of course, I always hope to return to Gaza. And I find that a very weird question when people ask it to me, because it's not like it's even an option right now. The borders are closed. I can't just go back right now, even if I want to. People can't leave even if they want to. And I can't go to any Western country easily. I need a lot of paperwork and visa processes to be able to go. But these people who have powerful passports can go to my homeland. Meanwhile, I'm just stuck in here. I can't go back home, and I can't travel to any country that I want.
that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. To listen to this episode or any previous episode again, you can go to CQUT's website at cqut.ca and click on the name of the show to see the archive. You can also find the link to this archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.